and welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is called Plantation Life Before Emancipation, and it's written to the memory of Charles Colcock Jones, DD, who, whether his work as a missionary to the blacks or the wider influence of his example and writings on their behalf be considered, is justly entitled to the name of the Apostle of the Negro Slaves, and of his many fellow workers in the gospel ministry upon the same field, only less conspicuous, self-denying and useful, and of the host of masters and mistresses whose kindness to the bodies and efforts for the salvation of the souls of the subject race, providentially placed under their rule and care, will be read out with their names in the day when the books shall be opened, and God shall bring every work unto judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. This book is reverently and lovingly dedicated to him. And we'll start with a word to the reader or listener. The chapters to follow were originally given to the public in the form of a series of letters under the same title, contributed to the columns of the Southwestern Presbyterian, the official organ for over 20 years of the Synod of Mississippi, embracing the greater part of the state of the same name and the whole of Louisiana. They were suggested by an article copied into that journal from the New York Evangelist and written by a lady, a native of South Carolina, married and resident at the North, in defense of Southern Christian slaveholders from the aspersions of a secretary of the Northern Presbyterian Freedmen's Board. In this graceful and vigorous vindication of her fellow countrymen, quotation was made from an old faded copy of a printed report made by Reverend Charles Colcock Jones to the Liberty County, Georgia, Association for the Religious Instruction of the Colored People. Having, in the providence of God, been brought into intimate relations with this eminent servant of God and personal acquaintance with his work, I found that by marriage I had come into possession of a bound volume of pamphlets containing not only the report cited, but the entire series, 13 in number, as well as all his many writings upon the same subject. This discovery of accessible and ample material for a fuller vindication of the memory of our ancestors, as well as my relations to the writer, as they constituted peculiar qualifications for, so they seemed to constitute a providential call to the work. These letters, thus prepared, met with general favour among the readers of our journal, and at the suggestion of White and Black, and by the advice of prominent ministers of more than one denomination, they are now published in book form and seek a larger audience. The purpose of the author has been to portray a civilization now obsolete, to picture the relations of mutual attachment and kindness which in the main bound together master and servant, and to give this and future generations some correct idea of the noble work done by Southern masters and mistresses of all denominations for the salvation of the slave. If the reader shall have half the pleasure in perusing that the author has had in writing these letters, if they shall in any degree contribute to the restoration of the mutual relations of kindness and confidence characterizing the old regime, and sorely strained not so much by emancipation as by the unhappy events immediately succeeding it, if through the blessing of him who hath made of one blood all nations of men, North and South, shall be induced to join hands and hearts in generous, confiding, and harmonious cooperative work for the salvation and consequent elevation of this race, dwelling with us in our common heritage, then will the author's purpose have been fully realized, and the country will have made sensible progress towards the solution of the race question, and the Church gratifying advance in the settlement of a more interesting and important problem. How shall Africa, in America, be won for Christ? Signed, R.Q. Mallard, New Orleans, Louisiana, December 1891. Chapter 1. It was in May 1864 that Johnson issued his celebrated battle order at Cass Station on the line of the Atlantic and Western Railroad. Our forces were in fine trim, anxious for the fray and confident of victory. The expressed inability of two corps commanders to hold the positions assigned them occasioned its recall and another move in the masterly retreat, before an army almost thrice the size of the Confederate force effected in such good order that, as one of the general's staff remarked, he had not left so much as a half grindstone north of the Etowah. A retreat, however, very discouraging, since it involved the surrender of the mountain fastnesses, the fall and destruction by Vandal Torch of Atlanta, and the unobstructed march of Sherman to the sea. Our relief committee had gone to the front in anticipation of a great battle, when on the evening of the 19th instant we received orders to fall back across the river. As the night drew on and we sought to snatch a little sleep upon boxes and barrels, there mingled with the rumbling of the wheels the monotonous but pleasant tones of a boy's voice, that of a little drummer perched upon the roof, and this was the ditty sung by him over and over again with the ceaseless cadence of pounding feet. In 1861, this war begun. In 1864, this war will be o'er. The song was history. It had nearly proved prophecy. In the winter of 1864, the Confederacy was almost in its death throes, and in the following spring a handful of war-worn veterans tearfully folded the stars and bars, and our chief yielded up his knightly sword with a dignity only equalled by the magnanimity of the victor. For 12 years in succession I have had the pleasure of reading the annual addresses of Colonel Charles C. Jones, Jr., LLD, President of the Confederate Survivors Association of Augusta, Georgia. I do not remember one which has not feeling sketches of some dead comrades who wore the grey. It reminds us of the rapidity with which the actors in those scenes, already covered by the obliterating waters of a quarter century, are crossing the river, we trust, to rest in the shade of the trees. Since this continent shook with the tread of armed hosts, a new generation has sprung into manhood and womanhood, to whom war experiences and plantation life are only traditions. It has occurred to one who had attained his majority before the tocsin of war summoned north and south to the field, and who from birth was intimately associated with that which was, at least, the occasion of the tremendous conflict, that a short series of letters upon the topic at the head of this article might not only prove pleasing to those who have had similar experiences, and interesting to those readers who were born since, or who were too young to have any distinct recollection of either war or plantation life in slavery times, but would at the same time subserve some graver and more important purposes to be developed as we proceed. We shall have occasion to picture a civilization peculiar and which can never be repeated in this country. Perhaps it will be seen that slavery, with all its confessed evils, was not the sum of villainies, as some termed it, but did have its redeeming qualities, that the common relations between master and slave were not of tyranny on the one side and of reluctant submission on the other, that our fathers, convinced that the institution was not in itself immoral, but scriptural, angered justly, and handicapped by the persistent efforts of abolitionists to stir the slave even to insurrection, did much for the religious and mental elevation of their people. The topics, subject to modification and contraction or expansion, as necessity may require or mood suggest that they will be treated of, are to state them as they now lie in the writer's mind, such as these: the writer's connection with slavery and slaves, the old plantation described, plantation occupations and sports, houses, food, physique, work, government and family relations, Sacrament Sunday on plantation, Daddy Jack, a curious character, a missionary to the blacks, anecdotes, mainly religious, of the Negro, what the South did for his salvation and elevation, our first General Assembly and the Negro, the slaves during the Civil War, etc. Our letters will be brief, but it is trusted sufficiently full to accomplish the writer's purpose. May they, under God, result in renewing the kindly feelings which bound together the two races in the olden time, somewhat alienated, not simply by the results of the war, but by events since, which need not be named now as they are past, let us hope forever. Possibly in the restoration of such feelings may lie at least an approximate solution of the race problem, now so deeply agitating the public mind. Chapter 2. The Writer's Connection with Slavers and Slaves. It was my lot from infancy to midlife to have been intimately associated with that race whose premature enfranchisement wrought such temporary mischief in state, and whose present and future political and ecclesiastical status fills the hearts of statesmen and Christians alike with concern. I was the son of a well-to-do slaveholder, and myself, although never a planter, an owner at my marriage by the generous gift of my father, of some of his trustiest and best servants, and also as trustee in my wife's right, and having our own servants always with us until emancipation. The memories of that connection are of almost unmixed pleasure. In the interests of truth and candour, which I intend shall characterise these letters, should here remark that I saw slavery under its most favourable aspects. My home was in Liberty County, Georgia, where that curse of Ireland, landlord absenteeism, did not exist. The planters, almost without exception, visiting their plantations during the summer at least twice a week, and spending the 6 months, including the winter, among them, in this country too, at the period when my recollections of slavery began, our people had enjoyed for some time the apostolical labours of Reverend C.C. Jones, D.D., Nomen Clarum et Venerabili. It is believed, however, that my experience will be found typical of the general experience, for while the congestion of the Negro population in the rice and sugar districts, and measurably in some parts of the cotton belt, was accompanied by evils elsewhere unknown, it is believed that the great majority of this race were distributed into smaller bodies in more direct contact with their masters. As a babe, I drew a part at least of my nourishment from the generous breasts of a coloured foster mother, and she and her infant son always held a peculiar place in my regards. A black nurse taught me, it is probable, my first steps and first words, and was as proud of both performances as the happy mother herself. With little dusky playmates, much of my holiday on the old plantation in the winter season was passed. Some parents were in this matter more particular than mine. On one plantation, I remember, the rule was that the white and black children were both punished if found playing together. My association with them was, I admit, somewhat to the detriment of my grammar, a fault which my schoolmaster speedily remedied, but never to the damage of my morals, for be it recorded to their everlasting honour, while their words were sometimes coarse, they were rarely vulgar, and never profane. My experience may have been exceptional, but I do not remember, even among the adults, a single profane swearer. With my little playmates, I, as other children, who are constantly rehearsing the drama of life, sometimes played at preaching. Our pews, the leaf of a door set against the palings, three shingles conveniently arranged my pulpit, and a small book, which I could not read, my Bible and hymn book. If the preaching was short and incoherent, the singing was neither. In my case, this peculiar turn was not strange, for I bore the name of one of our pastors. The extent of the area occupied by the congregation during summer made the services of two necessary, and my father's plantation residence being next but one, the nearest to the church, and he, a prominent officer of it, was the preacher's home. In those days, the old Midway Church was known far and wide, and many is the northern preacher visiting the south, not to say southern, who found a warm welcome beneath the roof of our paternal mansion. Among them, a frequent guest was the venerable octogenarian, Reverend Dr. McVeer, a polished Irish gentleman, finished scholar and learned divine, who had taught a school of which Washington was a trustee, and was the minister to whom the President apologised for returning thanks in his presence, replying to Mrs. Washington's remark, "My dear, you forget that there is a clergyman at the table. My dear, I wished him to know that I am not a graceless man." Here too, winter after winter, was entertained Reverend Dr. Ebenezer Porter of Andover Seminary, then admired all over the country, as much for the soundness as the solid attainments of its learned faculty. I remember to have heard my father say that Dr. P. was accustomed to observe that he always felt like taking off his hat in the presence of the grand old moss-covered live oaks for which that region was and is noted. At college, to which I went with the lively sympathy and good wishes of our people, I recall the faithful service of Uncle Peter, and at the seminary of Uncle Jack, not to speak of their wives. In the up country, the titles of respect which southern children were taught never to omit were uncle and auntie, and in the low country it was daddy and mama. Coming events seemed to have cast their shadows before them, for the child preacher, when he came forth from the school of the prophets, began to preach to Negroes in earnest in their own special building, and a more appreciative and sympathizing audience he never has had. And in the old ancestral church, in which master and servant worshipped together, the coloured people packing the wide, deep gallery, baptised from the same marble font, and taking the elements of bread and wine at the same time, from the silver baskets and gold-lined silver goblets, the gift of deceased slaveholders to the church. My first sole pastoral charge embraced a coloured as well as a white membership, and among the former were some of my most consistent and valued members and attentive listeners. A regular Sabbath school for them, children and adults, was taught by my young people, using Dr. C. C. Jones' Catechism, a manual prepared especially for them, and they also drilled them in hymns and tunes. Catechumens were carefully instructed by the young pastor in his own parlour, using the same manual as his basis. Besides preaching to them, where comfortable accommodations were provided in the common church, a weekly lecture, for which he made the same preparation which he did for the lecture to the whites, was delivered to full and most appreciative congregations, in a neat church building built for them by the trustees, all slave owners, of a benevolent fund left to the county by a deceased slaveholder. The unavoidable personal tinge given to this letter claims as its justification the necessity of establishing the competency and credibility of the witness. Chapter 3. The Old Plantation. It was situated in rich lands, abounding in malaria, against which only the negro was proof. I remember an instance of a planter who had spent only one night on his plantation in this region, harvesting his corn, rendered desperately sick by it, and another who lived in our village dying from a high grade of bilious fever thus contracted. Consequently, the summer months were spent by the white families in what was known as summer retreats, or villages located out in the pine forests. The return to the plantation was not considered safe until a killing frost had fallen. How we children watched with our keen eyes and ears for the first signs which nature gave of winter's approach. What joy it was to see the yellowing leaves of the old china trees which grew near the academies and old Union Church, the poverty of the soil hastening the process, to feel the evenings growing cooler and cooler, to catch the first notes of the 6 weeks bird, which we implicitly believed always sang just that length of time before frost, to hear the woodman's axe as he cut and split the great pine logs for the ordinarily unused fireplaces of the summer home, and oh, the happiness to wake some bright morning and find the grass on the lawn all covered with mimic snow, and as we chased each other around the yard to mark the vapour pouring from our parted lips, we children called it smoke. Word is sent down to the plantation, and not soon enough for our impatience. There come to move such furniture as we carried from one home to the other, the double horse wagon and the two slow-moving ox carts. Before we can get ready to start, Stingo, the old yard dog, a beast of exceeding ill temper, aggravated by age, and I am sorry to say by the plaguing of his young master, to which his churlish disposition naturally exposed him, divining the cause of the unusual stir, set out by himself and all alone made the journey of 15 miles of good road, ready on our arrival to take charge of the family in their winter home. Then the carriage and buggy are made ready, father and mother and children and nurse packed in, and we are, to our infinite delight, actually off at last for our winter holiday and the unspeakable joys of plantation life. On the way, we halt at a clear spring, bubbling up by the roadside, and lunch, always among other tempting edibles, upon shortened Johnny cake. I wish it were in my power to give the housekeepers of our day the recipe. I only remember it was baked on a long, clean board, leaned before a wood fire, and was ambrosia to our healthy young appetites. Resuming our journey along the broad, splendid roads worked every fall by details of plantation labourers under white supervision, we pass the old church where we shall worship anon, and of which more hereafter, drive along the wide Sunbury Highway a half mile or more, and then turn at a right angle into our avenue, lined with live oaks leading up to the plantation mansion. It is an unpretending structure, a large and roomy cottage of 1.5 stories, unpainted, a chimney of brick at one end, of clay at the other, a piazza running around two sides, and its gable end facing the avenue. It has only 4 glazed windows, 2 lighting the parlour, and the other 2 our parents' room just opposite, the panes small and so imperfect that many is the time that our youthful imagination occupied itself while waiting for the housegirl to kindle the fire in mother's chamber, in shaping its bubbles and defects into the images of different creatures. The parlour, the common living room, is papered with a pattern I have never seen elsewhere, a curious group of figures which I see distinctly before me as I write. There is, on the wide fireplace with its fender and andirons, polished until you can see your face in them, a generous supply of oak and rich pine, but the big door leading out upon the piazza is persistently left open, I presume for ventilation, but bringing the sensations of freezing and burning into startling conjunction. The arrangement of the houses is somewhat peculiar, but convenient, and apparently made upon the principle of placing everything as far as possible under the master's eye. Looking out from the front door, you see on your right the smoke and meat house made of yellow clay, in which the bacon, for our planter raises or purchases his hogs from his own people, is cured and stored. On the left-hand corner and in sight is the kitchen, where French cooks are completely distanced in the production of wholesome, dainty and appetizing food. For if there is any one thing for which the African female intellect has natural genius, it is for cooking. Just over the palings of the front yard you see the cotton houses, and directly in front the horse gin, with its wide branching arms carrying round and round all day the noisy rattling chain which turns the hickory rollers inside, with their lips separating the little black seeds from the fleecy lint, piling up in a growing bank of snow behind the screen. On the left, just beyond the stile, we call it the blocks, your eye takes in the stables and carriage houses, and still further away and stretching to the left and in front, the single and double rows of cottages, the quarters, the homes of the labourers, with their vegetable gardens, chicken coops, pig pens, rice ricks and little storehouses. The only thing in the rear and invisible from the front door are the rice barns and the winnowing house, for rice and Sea Island cotton constitute about in equal parts the market crop, and the vegetable garden stocked with broad-headed cabbages in winter, and with its beds of fragrant chrysanthemums and the sweetest roses I have ever smelt. On every hand the cornfields with their brown stalks, and cotton fields with their leafless black bushes, stretching away to the encircling forests, and beyond them on the left the road leading by 2 tall sweet gums to the rice fields, great lakes now and frequented by waterfowl, and fringed with the dense moss-draped cypress swamps. Such is a picture of the plantation home, in which a large part of the sunny days of my childhood and youth were spent, and in immediate contact with the African race, and here, for the present, I close. Chapter 4, Occupations and Sports. It is not my intention to describe in this letter the ordinary work of a plantation, but only the occupations and amusements of the younger members of the planter's household. Many of these were shared by the boys and girls of the family in their earlier years. These were first the almost daily visits to the cotton houses, where it was a pleasure to help the little slaves in beating up with switches the snowy cotton as it lay upon the elevated scaffolding, airing in the winter's sunshine, or to take hold of the crank of the whipper, which, with its long revolving shaft with numerous radiating spokes, separated the dust and trash from the cotton, and then to stand by the ginner and watch him, or be permitted for a few minutes ourselves to feed the grooved hickory rollers as they draw in the fleecy cotton and divide the lint from the seed, or to supervise the packer as, suspended in his distended bag from the upper floor with many a grunt, he and his heavy pestle forces the lint into the bale. Then what joy it was in the keen winter's air to perch upon the long beam outside and travel miles and miles in a circle, ever repeating itself, permitted as a special favour, for which a plate from the dinner table was exacted and willingly promised and paid ourselves to drive the team. At another time the barnyard would be the special attraction with its long parallel stacks of sheaves of golden rice. The dirt floor is beaten hard and swept clean, and the sheaves arranged upon it side by side, and now the stalwart labourers with their hickory flails beat off the heads of grain from the yellow straw. The obliging servants make for us children, or if sufficiently skilful we make ourselves, lighter flails, and with our slighter blows emulate in fun the heavier strokes of the men. And now the grain and broken straw are taken in baskets up the steps of the lofty winnowing house, which stands stilt-like upon its four upright posts, and as the grain and beaten straw are forced through a grated hole in the floor, the wind, faithfully whistled for, comes and carries off the chaff, and the round mound of rice steadily grows beneath. The rhythmical beat of the numerous flails is accompanied by a recitative and improvised song of endless proportions, led by one musical voice, all joining in the chorus and can be heard a mile away. The joy of the harvest, of which a Hebrew prophet speaks. A spell of cold weather sets in, and now the well-fattened hogs must be killed, dressed, and cured. We look on in the frosty air of the early morning, interested spectators, as the porkers are each dispatched by one dexterous blow of the axe, and then immersed in a casket of hot water to take off the hair and aid in the tying up of the fat into lard and cracklings, and, nothing loath, assist in the discussion at the family table of the spare ribs and sausages. Then there are horses to be ridden, and the difficult art acquired of keeping one's equilibrium upon the perilous edge of a frisky steed. Then there are evening walks with our sisters up the long oak-lined avenue, and rambles through the encircling woods in pursuit of the black sloes and yellow haws and other winter berries. And then in early spring the cattle turned out to graze in the fields and forests in the mild southern winters, are to be hunted, up and penned, and the younger calves marked and branded, the latter operation performed by the cowherds, and the former furnishing ample field for the exercise of our newly acquired horsemanship. As we grow older, our sisters and us boys begin to separate in our pursuits for the most part. Now comes the savage age, the period of traps and bows and arrows, and many is the sparrow and robin brought home to our admiring sisters as trophies of our woodcraft and skilful marksmanship. From the Indians' implements we are at last promoted to more civilized weapons and actually, oh, the height of a country boy's ambition, own horse, saddle, bridle, dog and gun. Many now is the grey squirrel and long-eared rabbit and gentle-eyed dove and plump partridge that falls under our new weapon. And grown more ambitious, birdshot is exchanged for duck and turkey shot, and with my Man Friday, or Boy Dick, as inseparable companion, we are off for the rice fields. In those days the teal and English ducks, as we called them, abounded in the two rice swamps between which the plantation was situated, and occasionally a flock of wild geese, to my intense excitement, settled down among them. When frightened from their feeding grounds by the passing of a wagon over the causeway bridges or the sound of a gun, the waterfowl took flight for a few minutes to circle around and then to return. The noise of their wings was like that of a mighty rushing wind. The settlement of the northern lakes, their breeding places, even before I was grown, perceptibly diminished their numbers. Well do I remember the day when two fortunate successive shots brought me 9 fat ducks, 5 of which I shouldered, leaving 4 for my faithful companion, and it was no light task to get them home. But I felt proud as Julius Caesar, decreed by the Roman Senate a triumph, and coming home from the wars of Gaul or of Britain when I passed the groups of servants about the cotton houses and listened to their admiring comments. To secure these trophies, I did not scruple with my little comrade to crush, barefooted and bare-legged, a whole day through the thin ice which crusted the broad, overflowed rice fields, and suffered no harm. I was never tyrannical, as southern boys generally were not, but sometimes a little positive and threatening in making Dick divest himself of pants that he might cross some deep canal, which his young master did not care, with his rolled-up trousers, to attempt to get his dead birds. Later on, duck and turkey shot gave way to buckshot, but of that I will not now write because it would take me into manhood. Often I made adventurous voyages in the lake-like rice fields in my batteau, with its extemporized sail, and prudently provisioned with sweet potatoes roasted in a fire built on the shore. Coffin-shaped when it was building in the street of the quarters, the servants, as they came in from their work, with concern depicted in their faces, would ask, "Who is dead?" leading some of the family to predict that it would prove to be my coffin, which prediction, like many others, as human, has proven false. Then, when the dogwood flower whitened the forests, came the spring fishing. Our rice fields were drained by wide, deep canals, stocked with various kinds of fresh water fish, trouts, mudfish, cats, eels, chubs, perch, I give our names without vouching for their correctness. Golden's Drain, or Dreen, my black companions termed it, was the canal oftenest visited and with best results. I can remember to this day the very appearance of the different places where we broke our way through the sea myrtles to get to the water's edge, and some positions inconveniently near the holes in the bank of 2 big alligators, male and female, which we had named. Later in the season, as the waters became low, our negro men and boys churned for fish, a sport in which I sometimes shared. The operation was this. A flour barrel was taken, both ends knocked out and the hoops secured. Then a half dozen boys and men thus provided would range themselves across a canal, and moving in concert would each bring his barrel at intervals down to the bottom. The moment a fish was covered, its presence was betrayed by its beating against the staves in its effort to escape. When the fisherman instantly covered his barrel with his breast and with his hands, speedily capturing it, threw it to the little negroes on the dam, who quickly strung it upon stripped branches of the sea myrtle tree. How they managed to handle the catfish with its sharp and poisonous spines, I cannot imagine. Perhaps their horny hands were impervious to them, as they were to the live coals of fire which I have often seen them transfer with naked fingers from hearth to pipe. Sometimes, an experience of which I have a lively personal recollection, a moccasin was covered, and then there was a rush to the shore, minus the barrel. As the rice fields later in the spring dried up in the heat, they left exposed the holes of the alligators. An animal which more frequently than we liked fed on uncured bacon, and occasionally docked, without improving her beauty, the tail of some thirsty cow. And now a long, lithe, slender pole is cut, its larger end furnished with a stout iron hook, and a negro man wading up to his waist in the water feels with it until he touches the living occupant, when, with a dexterous turn, he fastens the hook under the alligator's foreleg, and now commences the tug of war. He is, by main force, dragged, in which operation other willing hands join, to the land, the pole allowed to turn with his revolutions as he comes to the shore, hissing like a goose. By a well-aimed blow of the axe, his head, with its formidable armature of teeth, is severed from its dangerous muscle, and his almost equally formidable weapon, his sweeping tail, is paralysed. Sometimes, when unable to find the saurian, The pole is withdrawn, and there are marks of teeth in startling proximity to the portion grasped by human hands. Well do I remember that when, somewhat callow, I would occasionally take to a tree until assured that the decapitation was a success. It is easy to see how such a life, in which white and black, with the due subordination of master and servant preserved, shared the same sports, contributed to the familiar and affectionate relations which so notoriously from childhood bound master and servant together, and how it gave the southern youth a skill with firearms rarely attained in a shooting gallery, and a free, firm, and graceful seat in the saddle, seldom, if ever, acquired in the sawdust arena of a riding school, and how it developed a splendid physical manhood, unknown to the dwellers in the cities with their billiard table exercise and theatrical diversions, and what is at best but a poor substitute for outdoor sports, the gymnasium. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 2 of Plantation Life Before Emancipation.